And so this talk is addressed at the basic question of what does holographic entanglement entropy teach us about gravity and the nature of space-time. I'm not going to solve that problem, but hopefully make a little bit of progress. To hark back a little bit further, we've known for a while, for more than 10 years, that in semi-classical gravity, entropies are related to surface areas. And the first and still canonical example of that is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula for a black hole, which also applies to other horizons, Rindler horizons, De Sitter, and so on. And that tells us that the entropy of the black hole is given by the area of its event horizon over 4 times Newton's constant. And I think since this formula was discovered, we've wanted to know why. And one way to answer that question is with a Google search. So if you do a Google search on Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, in particular, if you do a Google image search, because I think you always get the clearest answers by doing an image search on whatever question you have, I highly recommend it. You'll see pictures like this one, which is a picture of a black hole, I presume a real one, where the event horizon has been divided up into Planck area squares, each one of which is labeled with a 0 or a 1. So, I mean, what this formula is obviously telling you is that the bits that define the microstate of the black hole must be living on the horizon of the black hole at a density of 1 bit per 4 Planck areas. Of course, I'm kind of joking, or more specifically, I'm setting up a straw man because I think we can easily think of reasons why this very simple-looking explanation in this picture might not be the really deep reason why why areas are related to entropies in semi-classical gravity. And one line of reasoning uses the Ryu-Takayanagi formula. So let's just remind ourselves of what that is. It's a generalization of Bekenstein-Hawking. And what it says is that in a holographic field theory, which by definition has a bulk dual governed by Einstein gravity, the entanglement entropy of any boundary region, and here I'm considering the static case. I'll talk about the time-dependent case at the end of the talk, but let's stay static for now. Is given essentially by the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, but in which we replace the horizon by the minimal surface in the bulk that's homologous to A. Homologous means that there exists a bulk region, which is called the entanglement wedge, which essentially interpolates between A and that minimal surface. Okay, and the point here, I mean, the quickest takeaway from this formula is essentially that this formula was never actually about horizons. Okay, so Bekenstein-Hawking formula is not a statement about horizons, has nothing to do with horizons. It's far more general than that. That realization in particular sort of leads to some problems with this, because at least here the horizon is clearly a special place in the space-time, but here it's not a special, this minimal surface is not a special place in the space-time. And in particular, I have a new variable, which is my choice of region A. And as I vary A, M of A moves around, okay, and I can pretty much move it around at will. That leads to some problems with this kind of very simple, naive interpretation. The first problem that I want to point out is that under a continuous change in the boundary region, the minimal surface can actually jump. And a classic example of that is if my region has two parts to it, two connected components, and I'm looking at and I'm using Ryu-Takayanagi to compute the entanglement entropy of their union, then I actually find what looks like a sort of a phase transition in which the minimal surface jumps between two locally minimal configurations. In one locally minimal configuration, The minimal surface for the union is the union of the respective minimal surfaces, and the other one, it actually joins the two together. And depending on the separation, you'll go between, so at large separations, you'll go, it'll be in this configuration, and when the separation is sufficiently short, it'll go to this one. It'll be sort of a first order phase transition in which the entropy is continuous, but its first derivative is discontinuous. And I just want to, I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I've argued that it's not the case. So essentially the question I'm raising here is, well, where do the bits live? I mean, did they live here and then they suddenly jump to living somewhere else? That seems a little bit strange. And it's sort of sharpened by the fact that it's not the case, or I've argued that it's not the case, that the density matrix has jumped in any sense. That it's not a conventional, what we would normally in thermodynamics call a first order phase transition. Another complaint, which is closely related actually, with the idea that the bits are living on the minimal surface, or even the idea that the minimal surface is kind of a special place, comes from considering more sophisticated quantities which play an important role in quantum information theory, which are given by linear combinations of entropies. So for example, the conditional entropy, so given two regions A and B, you can compute the conditional entropy, the mutual information. Given three regions, you can compute this conditional mutual information. This is the quantity which appears, or which is non-negative by virtue of the strong subadditivity inequality. And these all play important roles in information theory. And of course, you can compute them using Ryu Takayanagi very simply, because you can compute each term. But the connection between their information theoretic meaning and the way that you compute them using Ryu Takayanagi is very opaque. So let me try to explain what I mean by that. By just recalling what that information theoretic meaning is, and let's just start with the classical case. So in a compressed coding of the state of AB, A union B has S of AB bits. By the way, there's some log twos if you are following very carefully what I'm doing, so don't try to keep track of it at that level. I'm kind of mixing up a bit and log two bits, but let's not worry about that. So anyway, S of AB bits in the compressed coding of AB, S of A bits in the compressed coding of A, and S of B in the compressed coding of B. And then it's sort of clear when you line them up, I should say, it's possible to make a compressed coding in which this number of bits are shared or identical or redundant between A and B. This number are in A only, and this number are in B only. So the number that are in A only is that conditional entropy. And the number that are shared is that mutual information. So the mutual information quantifies the amount of correlation between A and B, and the conditional entropy quantifies the amount of information in A that's independent of B. So that's simple enough. In the quantum case, it's more complicated, and I'm just going to give a cartoon. This is by no means a complete treatment. But the basic point is that you have a new phenomenon, which is entanglement. And in particular, if you have a maximally entangled pair of qubits, then that would contribute, between A and B, that would contribute 2 units to the mutual information and -1 to the conditional entropy, because it would contribute 1 to S of A, 1 to S of B, and 0 to S of AB. So these I denoted with this gray box. So they actually contribute negatively to the conditional entropy, and in particular, it can lead to a negative conditional entropy, which can't happen classically and is a sure sign that you have entanglement in your system. Of course, many more complicated things can happen in the quantum case. More complicated things basically can't happen in the classical case if in the limit of large systems, but as I said, this is just a cartoon of the quantum case. Now, going back to this picture of the minimal surfaces, you know, if I'm computing a conditional entropy, then I have some surface area passing through one part of the bulk, and then a different surface passing through a different one, and I'm supposed to subtract their areas, and what's left over is a conditional entropy. And so, but what does that number have to do with the number of bits that live purely in A? Okay, or if I'm subtracting, if I'm doing S of A plus S of B minus S of AB, doing the subtraction, where did those bits live? Where did these bits live, or these bits? Where did these bits live, and so on, okay? Okay, and then just to beat a dead horse here, we can make it even more complicated by looking at the strong subadditivity or conditional mutual information. And again, you can prove, as Tadashi and I did, that the Ryu-Takenagi formula obeys that strong subadditivity inequality, which is, again, this particular linear combination of positivity of this linear combination of entanglement entropies. And you prove it by an argument which basically says, by the time you're done canceling certain terms, that this surface area plus this surface area minus this surface area minus this surface area is positive, which you show by just a kind of, by essentially reconnecting these minimal surfaces. And so it's all well and good. It obeys that property, and this is one of the pieces of evidence we've had for a long time that Ryu-Takenagi is correct. And yet, what does this have to do with the meaning of strong subadditivity, which is the monotonicity of correlations, that I of A with BC, as Patrick explained this morning, is at least as big as I of AB. In other words, A is at least as correlated with BC as it is with B. This is something that has puzzled me since the beginning, and I've found very unsatisfying, because I felt like Ryu-Takenagi is trying to tell us something about the connection between geometry and information, and we haven't been able to understand or decode that message. Okay? And so, as I said, I'm going to try to make some progress on that, and I'm going to do it just by completely rewriting the formula. So I'm not going to change the formula. The formula is going to be the same. I'm not making a new proposal. It is still Ryu-Takenagi. Okay? I have not changed it at all. I'm just rewriting it. Okay? But in the new way of writing it, there are no minimal surfaces. So the whole idea that surfaces are important is out the window. There are going to be no surfaces at all. I don't care at all about the areas of surfaces. Okay? The surfaces are not a special place. Okay? And this new reformulation, I argue, suggests a new way to think about the connection between space-time geometry and information, and a new way to think about the holographic principle. Okay? Okay. So to do that, I'm going to invoke a theorem from Riemannian geometry, which is basically a descendant of a theorem from network theory, which is very well known to computer scientists and so on, and people who do optimization, which is max flow min cut. Here's how max flow min cut works on a Riemannian in the sort of differential geometry or Riemannian setting. We're going to have some Riemannian manifold with boundary. We're going to define a flow to be a vector field which is divergenceless and whose norm everywhere is less than or equal to 1. By virtue of it being divergenceless, you can equivalently think of it as a set of oriented threads or flow lines which don't join or split or begin or end anywhere inside the bulk. They can begin and end on the boundary. And by virtue of the norm bound, the transverse density is bounded, okay, of the flow lines, okay? Now we consider some part of the boundary. So in this first cartoon, let's take A, which is part of the boundary, to be this entire connected component. Although the theorem holds more generally, because we'll apply it more generally, but I think for purposes of illustration, that might help. If you have any other surface which is homologous to A, by virtue of the divergenceless condition, the flux through M of V equals the flux through A of V. And by virtue of the norm bound, the flux through V is bounded above by the area. And so, in particular, we can apply that to the minimal area. Okay, this the area of M of A, the minimal area. And on, we can maximize on the other side, so we find that the maximum flow is at most the minimum area surface. And so that is very straightforward. The non-trivial part, which is what you have to prove, is that, in fact, this is equality. In other words, there's no other obstruction to increasing the flux other than the areas of all the surfaces that are homologous to A, of which the strongest is the minimum one. Okay, so that establishes this equality. This is not a trivial theorem to prove in differential geometry, essentially because it's a theorem about minimal surfaces, and theorems about minimal surfaces are very hard to prove rigorously. But I think it should be pretty intuitively clear if I've explained it well. Okay. Now, let me point out a couple of things that are important. So first, whereas the minimal surface is generically unique, I mean, sometimes there might be another surface that happens to have, or if there's a symmetry, another surface that has the same area as the minimal, or two minimal surfaces that have the same area. So there might be some kind of finite non-uniqueness to the minimal surface. The max flow is always highly non-unique. So these, in other words, these flow lines are very floppy. Everywhere except on the minimal surface, which serves as the bottleneck, and on the minimal surface, that max flow has to equal the unit normal vector to that minimal surface. Now, I'm going to use a terrible notation. V of A for the max flow, it's terrible because it's not actually a flow. It's actually a whole bunch of flows. Any max flow, I'll call V of A. Okay? Okay, the second thing I want to point out is that, you know, one of the reasons why people who do optimization and so on are interested in this is that we've turned this minimization problem, which may be somewhat nasty in the sense of having local minima, and then you have to, you know, figure out which of the local minima is the global minimum, and also it's the space on which you're finding the minimum is the space of surfaces, which is not a space that has a particularly nice structure, into a problem that has the following structure. We're in a vector space, which is the space of vector fields, on which we've put two constraints, the divergenceless constraint and the norm bound. Those are convex constraints. So we are doing a maximization problem on a convex space of a linear functional. So that, by definition, is a linear programming problem. And so you've turned finding the minimal area surface into a linear programming problem, okay, which is a much easier kind of problem to understand properties of, and of course, in practice, to solve. Okay, so now I think you know what I'm going to say next. So we're just going to take this thing and wherever we had this thing, we're going to just replace it with this, in particular in the Ryutaki-Nagi formula. So here's the new version. And I'm setting 4G Newton to 1 for the rest of the talk. So forget surfaces. The entanglement entropy is given by the maximum flux over all flows out of A, which I can say in terms of the flow lines, or which I'll call threads, the maximum number of threads that can leave A, subject to the constraint that the transverse density of threads can't exceed 1, which in this unit is 1 per 4 Planck areas. Okay, in other words, you should think of a thread as having a cross-sectional area of 4 Planck areas. They cannot get squeezed closer to each other than that. And here I drew the minimal surface to guide the eye, and on the minimal surface, the threads are maximally packed together. But elsewhere, they're very floppy. Okay. Now, this I want to point out that in this formulation, two things that you sort of needed to put in by hand with the surface construction are automatic: the homology condition and the fact that you're doing a global minimization are just in there. Now, let me just have another picture here, which has a few more elements to it. So I got rid of the minimal surface, but let's say you have a horizon. The threads are allowed to end on the horizon. So after the threads leave A, they can do one of three things. They can go to the horizon, they can go to A complement, or they can go back to A. The ones that go back to A don't count for the purposes of the entanglement entropy. But it's important to note that because there's so much space out near the boundary in an asymptotically ADS space, there's always a lot of room to add these little loops that connect A to itself. The threads are also very floppy, as I said, except on the minimal surface itself. And in particular, there's a lot of freedom to move them around on the boundary, where they connect to the boundary. Okay? And these two freedoms to add loops and to move around the threads are actually very important, are telling us something very important about the nature of the holographic state that I'll come back to. Okay? Okay. I already said this, the role of the minimal surface is the bottleneck. And I also want to say that you can think of this as an implementation of the holographic principle. So the holographic principle basically says that entropies are counted by surface areas, not volumes. And this is saying the reason for that is that bits are not carried by point-like objects, they're carried by one-dimensional objects. And as soon as bits are carried by one-dimensional objects that have some cross-sectional area, then the number that you can put is going to be counted by a surface area. Okay? So it kind of, to me, sort of, if you'll buy that, you may not, but if you'll buy that, then it demystifies the holographic principle. Okay? Okay, so let's see, how does this actually work? How does this actually solve those problems that I mentioned before? Well, the first is that you can prove that the thread configuration or the flow, the max flow, changes continuously as you change A, even when there's a jump in the minimal surface. You can easily convince yourself of that. Basically, just because the bottleneck moves from one place to another, the thread configuration doesn't have to jump. Okay? What about all this mutual information, conditional entropy stuff? So it's rather beautiful how that works out. So, but first I need to tell you something. So if we have two regions disjoint, A and B, we can maximize the flux through A or through B, but not necessarily both at the same time. In particular, if they have a joint bottleneck which is smaller than the sum of their individual ones, in other words, if the entropy of their union is less than the sum of their entropies, then you can't simultaneously maximize the flux through both. But what you can do, what you can show fairly straightforwardly, is that you can maximize through A and AB, A union B. And we'll call a flow that does that V of A comma B. So in other words, this is the set of flows of max flows on A, this is the set of max flows on AB, and they overlap. That's my statement, is that they overlap. There are flows that maximize on both, okay? Or you can maximize on B and AB, and that would be V of B comma A. Once it goes in, you can have a thread which comes out of the horizon. I didn't say that. But you can have a thread which comes out of the horizon. I'm supposed to repeat the questions. Alex, you're supposed to remind me to repeat the question. I'm reminding Alex to remind me to repeat the question. Okay. The question was whether a thread can go in and then come back out of the horizon. And you wouldn't know if it was the same thread or not, but you could have a thread which came out of the horizon. Oh, Right, so on the minimal surface, the threads are maximally packed and they all have to come out, which means that in a max flow, in a general flow, a thread can go wherever it wants and come back. But in a max flow, there's no room for it to come back. There are no threads pointing back in towards A in a max flow for A. So what I'm saying is on here, because the threads are maximally packed and all going outward, a thread which leaves cannot return to A. It can return to A if it doesn't cross the minimal surface, but it can't return to A if it crosses the minimal surface. Okay, let's look at a toy example, because I think that'll be helpful. This is the simplest one I could think of. Which isn't just like all zeros. The entropy for A and B is both 2, but for AB it's 3. And so then you get 1 unit of mutual information, 1 unit of conditional entropy. So what happens to the threads in this case? I can have 2 threads coming out of A union B, I can have 3 threads coming out of A union B, and of those, at most 2 can come out of A. In which case there's 1 coming out of B. Or 2 can come out of B, in which case there's 1 coming out of A. So these are my 2 choices. This is the one where I maximize on A, this is the one where I maximize on B. And this, in my little box notation earlier, would be represented this way. This is my 1 unit of conditional entropy, my 1 unit of mutual information, and my 1 unit of BA conditional entropy. So what you see here is that we have a thread which is stuck to A, a thread which is stuck to B, and a thread which can move back and forth. The thread which is stuck to A is my unit of conditional entropy. That's a bit which is actually part of A. Similarly for the one which is stuck to B, and then I have a thread which can move back and forth, which you can think of as a bit which you can read. If you think of the thread as like a reading device for a microstate bit, it can read that either on A or on B because they're redundant. It's shared. You can read it either place. Okay? Okay, so that is very simple. Of course, there's no entanglement here, so let's do a case. Let's cut down that AB bottleneck to the point where a conditional entropy is negative. If I make the mutual information actually 1, I'm sorry, if I make the AB entropy 1, then my mutual information has gone negative. I must have some entanglement. What are the threads doing? Well, I can have 2 threads leaving A, but only 1 can leave A union B. So the other one has to go to B. It can't go anywhere. It can't end anywhere else. So V of AB looks like this. And now I actually have a thread which connects them. Now, if I look at VBA, I can move this thread. In fact, I have to move this thread over to B. The thread which connects them now switches orientation. So based on the previous lesson, I would say that the one which moves back and forth represents 1 bit of classical correlation. And the thread which connects A to B and which switches orientation represents a maximally entangled pair of qubits. So the threads actually visualize the information theoretic content of the state at this level, okay? And it's very simple. And based on these 2 lessons, I'm going to give you some equations about this stuff in a second. In case you think these toy examples are like too simple. But first I want to say that if I now consider a single region and consider those freedoms that I had before, the freedom to move the threads around on A, and the freedom to add loops that connect A to itself, I can understand what those mean now. The freedom to move the threads around on A represents the fact that there's classical correlation within A. And the freedom to add little loops that go from A to A represents the fact that there's entanglement within A. In other words, if I divide A up into A1 union A2 in any way, I'll find that A1 and A2 are highly entangled, which are things that we know to be true about these field theories, and they're represented now by these properties of the threads, okay? Another important lesson, by the way, that you should take from this is that the state in the field theory is never represented by a single thread configuration, but always by some set of thread configurations. There is not one thread configuration which represents the state, okay, and from which you could read the entropies. You can read the entropy of a single region by a max flow on that region, but as soon as you have multiple regions, then you need to consider a whole set of thread configurations. Yes?
So let's say I take the intervals A and B, such that in this case, how do I know a priori that I just don't have a bunch of lines coming out of A and B downwards?
Here? Okay, so the question was, what stops me from just drawing a bunch of threads going down?
Yeah.
Well, basically, we know, I mean, in my example, I made the entropy of the union 1, which means I can have at most 1.
I meant, like, dynamically, how is it determined? Because I know there's a phase transition, right?
Okay, so, I mean, these are just toy examples, so... I mean, right, how would this happen? It would happen because the geometry was such as to create a very small bottleneck in here. And you can make examples like that. I mean, I didn't, you know, but you can definitely make examples where you get negative conditional entropy and so on. It's very easy to do that in you know, real world examples. Let me, as I said, put some equations to what I said before, and it's kind of nice how it works out. So let's go to this conditional entropy, which is defined as the difference of these entropies. And this entropy is the flux through A union B of a corresponding max flow. This one is the flux through B of the corresponding max flow. Now, among the max flows on AB, there's the one which also maximizes on B. So without loss of generality, I can make this the flux of the flow that maximizes on B. And this one, among the ones that maximize on B, there's also the ones that maximize on A union B. So without loss of generality, I can make this V of B comma A. But this is the difference of the same flow, or I can then choose, again, terrible notation. Let's now take this V of B A to be the same as this V of B A. And then it's the difference of the flux through A union B minus through B, which is just the flux through A of V of B union A, V of B comma A. In other words, you maximize the number of threads on A union B and then minimize the number on A. In other words, it's the number left over. It's the minimum number you can have on A. That's the conditional entropy. Okay? So that represents the number of bits that really belong to A only. And the mutual information is the difference between that and the entropy of A. And playing the same game, we see that it's the maximum entropy on A minus the minimum entropy on A. The maximum flux on A minus the minimum flux on A. In other words, it's the amount of flux you can move between A and B. Okay? And that movement could be because you've moved a thread, or it could be because you've switched the orientation of a thread that connects A to B. And from this, you get subadditivity because the maximum minus the minimum has to be non-negative. So you get a very easy proof of subadditivity. And by the way, as an aside, with the surface definition of Ryu Takayanagi, you need to regulate these quantities in order to get a finite mutual information. So if I consider two separated regions, the mutual information will be finite because the divergent parts, which are local on the entangling surface, cancel. But in order to calculate it or even define it, I first need to regulate to make those finite, then do the subtraction, then remove the regulator. But you can define a max flow even when the flux is infinite. A max flow is a flow that can't be augmented. In other words, to which you cannot add another flow, to which you cannot add another vector field such that you still have a flow where the one that you added has positive flux. Okay? So you can define the notion of a max flow even when the flux is infinite. And then if you do that, so then I can define this. Then I can do this subtraction before doing the integral. And so I end up with a finite quantity without ever having introduced a regulator. So that's nice. And you can actually play another game, which is even more fun, which is that this minus this divided by 2 is itself a flow, because obviously it's divergenceless. And also, since the norm of this is ever less than or equal to 1, and same with this, their difference divided by 2 has norm less than or equal to 1. So this is itself a flow. And what kind of flow is it? Well, it turns out that this flow is non-zero, or can be chosen to be non-zero, only within the entanglement wedge of the union of A and B. And it's a flow that goes from A to B. So it consists of threads that go from A to B. But that implies that the mutual information, which is the flux of this, or half the mutual information is the flux of this, is bounded above by the bottleneck of the entanglement wedge. So you get this nice corollary, which is that the mutual information between A and B is bounded above by this geometric property of the entanglement wedge of their union, which I think is nice. Okay, you can continue to play this game with the conditional mutual information, and I'm not going to go through this. But essentially, what the conditional mutual information ends up being is the amount of flux you can move between A and B subject to maximizing on C. In other words, if you're measuring the state of C, how much correlation is there left over between A and B? And because it's a max minus a min subject to some constraint, it's necessarily non-negative. That's strong subadditivity. So actually, the proof of strong subadditivity in this context is actually even a little bit easier than the one using minimal surfaces. The one using minimal surfaces, you have to take care of very special cases. It's a little bit annoying to do all the different cases. And here, you never have to worry about all of that stuff. But more importantly than which proof is easier, because they're both pretty easy, is that here we see the meaning. We see why it's positive, OK? And you can trace it through very easily. For example, if you want to understand the conditional mutual information as the difference between the mutual information IABC minus IAC, you can easily see that it's the difference between the amount of flux you can move between A and BC and the amount of flux you can move between A and C. So so the fact that that's non-negative is clear from this statement, by virtue of the fact that there's extra flux that you can move between A and B. Yes? Right. So, I mean, I think we know that it's a good question. I don't have a good answer. So let me attempt to repeat the question. So Dorit has pointed out a flaw in the reasoning, which I agree with, and which is kind of an open question here. So if a thread which connects, let's say, two regions represents, or a region as complement represents an entangled pair of qubits, then is there a whole collection of different thread configurations? And I mean, we certainly know that in a holographic state, A and its complement are highly entangled. We also know that the entanglement of the full system is not described by just a bunch of shared EPR pairs between A and its complement. I mean, because I could have chosen a different A, I mean, that would be way too simple. So in some sense, this is like distilling out each max flow is somehow distilling out part of the correlations. such that you get the right answer. But in the end, if you want to understand the full state, you need to see the full collection of them. And actually, one of the things I'm going to say towards the end is if you look at something like a GHZ state, which doesn't just have this kind of bipartite entanglement, can you represent that state using threads? And it turns out for that state, at least for a three-party GHZ, you can. More precisely, you can get a set of entropies which agree with those of the GHZ state. And maybe something I could add, actually, that triggered two thoughts. So one that I should have said earlier is that Maxwell-Mincut was used in the original error correcting code on a tensor network paper, this happy paper, for their computation of entanglement entropies and showing that their tensor network in certain cases obeys the Ryu-Takayanagi formula. So that was an application of Maxwell-Mincut to get Ryu-Takayanagi in a graph setting. The second thing is that Daniel Harlow has recently proposed an interpretation of these bit threads in terms of the structure of the state of the field theory. So maybe he can give a better answer to your question. Okay. So an exercise for the reader is to find flow interpretations of other well-known properties like Araki-Lieb, the fact that S of A equals S of A complement for pure states, and stuff like that. And you can look for the answers in our paper. An exercise for the reader that's harder, where the answer is not in our paper, is to prove a harder inequality, which goes by this awful name, monogamy of mutual information, that I thoroughly regret, but that's what it's called now, that is this inequality, unlike strong subadditivity, is not a general property of quantum states, but is a general property of holographic states. And this one, and there are generalizations of this to more parties, this one I don't know how to prove using flows. I can show that you can't prove it using just the nesting property by using four-party GHZ, which is kind of the simplest state that violates this. So there's some stuff going on about flows. And I think this is a very interesting problem for people who know about Maxwell-Mincut and stuff, even just in the graph. Forget about the Riemannian geometry, just in the graph context. I think this is an interesting question. OK, and then this thing that I was saying about whether the bit thread picture indicates that bipartite entanglement is privileged, which is kind of related to Dorit's question. It's not clear, but what I will say is that you can represent the three-party GHZ state, or more precisely, there's a collection of bit threads whose entanglement entropies match those of three-party GHZ. So maybe this is totally false, and this is not a representation of three-party GHZ. But at least it's not clear that it's not. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are other states that have this. So, since I'm in front of hundreds of people, yeah. Well, no, I mean, so, okay. Can I repeat the question? So Daniel is basically asking me what I could possibly be asking for aside from the entropies. If I get all the entropies right, isn't that all there is to say? What do I mean by actually representing the state? So first of all, I mean, there are other three-party states that have the same entropies up to an overall factor as the three-party GHZ. And the overall factor is a fudge factor because I can choose my units. So that shows that knowing the entropies is not the same thing as specifying the state. Well, but my question was, so he just said you didn't expect to write the wave function in terms of just the bit threads, which is true. But my question was whether there's a lesson to be, so one of the big questions is what properties do holographic states have, right? Generic states, even of holographic CFTs, are not holographic in the sense of having a classical gravity dual, okay? So can you learn something about the constraints from the fact that there exists this bit thread representation? Okay, that's kind of what I mean, okay? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so Ning is asking, since, you know, one way to identify the GHZ state is to see what happens when you do a measurement on one party or trace over one party. And so if I know what happens to the bit threads when you do a measurement or tracing, then, a tracing is just not allowing yourself to measure that thing anymore. In other words, just looking at the entropies of everything outside of it. So, I mean, in that sense, I think the answer is yes. But that is not enough. I think the measurement is the one that distinguishes GHZ from the W state. So, I don't have an answer of what. But I'm not sure we really have an answer in any other holographic context of, like, if I measure part of a holographic CFT and then what happens to the bulk after you do that measurement. It sounds like an interesting question, but. Okay, other questions? Yes. Yeah. So the question was, what does the max flow correspond to on the gravity side? I don't know, but so indeed, somehow, so what I've presented is a reformulation of Ryutake and Nagi, and by the way, also Bekenstein Hawking is included as a special case here. And now the problem for everyone else is to, you know, take a lesson from that. I mean, what do we learn? So, in other words, what do we learn? I know that sounded really obnoxious. I apologize. For anyone who's interested, let me put it that way. And in particular, this constraint, somehow the key thing is this constraint on the threads that they can't be packed more closely than one per four Planck areas. And it's, you know, the fact that from that you can derive the entropies, you know, I think is probably telling us something very important. Now, if I could just rephrase your question, you could ask the following question. Can I actually turn this around and derive the metric? So in other words, derive the bulk geometry from the threads. And you can do the following thing. If you give me a collection of thread configurations on some manifold that doesn't have a metric, you can ask, do they select out a metric? And in fact, you can sharpen that by, in the following way, you can ask, what's the smallest metric, point-wise, for which that all of those thread configurations in that collection are allowed? In other words, you can ask for the threads to create the space, to open up the space, to accommodate them, because each thread has a certain size. That's a well-defined question, okay? I mean, there will be a minimum metric for which a given collection of threads is allowed. So I think if you want to get some kind of emergence of space-time or bulk reconstruction angle out of this, that would be the way. You start with some collection of threads. From that, you can derive the metric. You can get the metric. OK. Let me just quickly throw out an idea about quantum corrections, which Faulkner, Lefkowitz, and Maldacena showed are given by entanglement of bulk fields. And this is not quantitative, and it might be completely wrong. It's just an idea. But if you say in the presence of entanglement of the bulk fields, the threads are allowed to jump from point to point. So if let's say the fields in the neighborhood of this point are entangled with the fields in the neighborhood of this point, then you allow a single thread, if it's one bit of entanglement, to jump from this point to this point. So if you add that rule in, then sometimes the threads can jump across the minimal surface, and the number that can jump across the minimal surface will be given by the amount of entanglement between the region inside and the region outside. And so you would reproduce the FLM correction to Ryu Takenagi, okay? And it would be sort of an ER equals EPR type of situation in the sense that you can imagine that this jump is because there's like a little tiny wormhole that connect, like a Planck-sized wormhole that connects this point to this point that the thread is going through. Okay. Then the last thing I want to talk about is the covariant version. And this is not in print yet. And it's something I'm working on with Veronica Hubany. And it leads to a rather beautiful picture. So let me first remind you of the HRT covariant holographic entanglementary formula, which is the same as the other one, except now M of A is an extremal surface. Surface still means codimension one spatially, codimension two in space-time, space-like surface, again, homologous to A. And if there's multiple extremal surfaces, you're supposed to take the minimal one. So in the end, it's actually a very complicated kind of object and really hard actually to find in practice in a given time evolving space-time. And so in order to get a flow picture, we need a Lorentzian generalization of Maxwell min cut. And this is not something you can just pull out of the literature as far as we know, but we worked it out as follows. A flow in the Lorentzian context is still going to be a vector field. So it's not going to, for a while we thought it would become a two-form or something like that. It's just a vector field, still divergenceless. It can't flow in or out of singularities if you have some like black hole singularity or something. And then what are we going to do with this norm bound? So what you're supposed to do with this norm bound is the following. Basically, let me start with this. Any observer sees over their lifetime a total number of threads, which is at most one, or total density of threads, one per four Planck areas. Okay? And the way to say that mathematically is that for any time-like curve C and any unit normal vector field U on C, this integral is less than or equal to one. So What you did to add that extra dimension was to stretch out the norm bound. You didn't change anything else, still a divergenceless vector field, but you stretched out the norm bound. It now becomes an integrated, a time-like integrated norm bound. Okay? And subject to that, and assuming the null energy condition, you get this max flow min cut theorem. Okay? So this is the area of the minimal extremal surface homologous to A, this M of A. And again, since this is a convex set of constraints on a vector space, and this is still a, I forgot to say one important thing. It was supposed to be written here. What is D of A? D of A is the boundary causal domain of A. There'll be a picture in a second. But it turns it into, a linear programming problem, okay? And so we have version 2.0 of the max flow min cut theorem, of the version 2.0 of HRT formula. And how on earth is it possible that this works? Okay, so what's going on here? And the picture, I think, is very nice. So your job is to add threads leaving D of A. So I have a cut, a time-like cut. Here's A. Here's my causal domain of A on the boundary. And I'm supposed to stick threads into the bulk, just like in the static version. Now they can be spread out in time, or they can all live on a common Cauchy slice. It's up to you. You have a lot of freedom. They're very floppy, of course. But as you add them, and there's no rule, you know, they can go anywhere. They don't have to be space-like. They can go up here or wherever. So you keep adding more and more and more. To add more, what you find is that you need to keep them inside of the entanglement wedge. So as you keep adding more, they automatically find the entanglement wedge and they seek out the minimal surface, the extremal surface, I'm sorry. They will all automatically, upon maximization, this is not a rule, this is an output, not an input. Upon maximization, they will find the extremal surface and they will stay within the entanglement wedge until, of course, they squeeze out through the minimal surface, and then they can do whatever they want. Okay? So you actually recover the whole entanglement wedge story and the extremal surface automatically from this maximization, which I think is very lovely. Okay? And again, it turns it into a linear programming problem. That's basically where we're at in terms of max flows. And I think I'm out of time, so thank you. So I mean that I'm going to relax. Okay, the question was, what do I mean by these words, these vague words? So what I mean is that I'm going to relax the rule that the threads can't begin or end in the bulk. And I'm going to allow them to jump from one point in the bulk to another point. They can do that only according to entanglement of the bulk fields between the two points. Now, so far this is not actually a great formulation because, of course, fields, quantum fields, when they're entangled between one region and another, it's not really point-wise. But I think that's probably okay because, of course, we are always talking about, as I've emphasized, collections of thread configurations. So I think that can probably be made precise. That's what I meant by tunneling. Basically, they jump, and that would, in particular, allow a thread to jump across the minimal surface without counting against the area of the minimal surface. And that's what would increase S of A, and it would increase by the amount by which the entanglement wedge of A is entangled, the fields in that entanglement wedge are entangled with the fields outside. Does that clarify it?
Does there a nice interpretation of the mutual information in terms of these bit threads still work in the covariant case, and therefore your proof of strong subadditivity?
Great question. So the mutual information still works, and from that you get subadditivity. Strong subadditivity. Let me back up and say one thing. There is a proof, which I didn't show, of subadditivity that doesn't use the nesting property. The reason I say that is that that's actually something missing here, although I don't think it's going to be that hard. I just haven't had time to focus on it. To get the strong subadditivity, you need nesting. And I'm sure it's true. And if I knew more linear programming, it would probably be very easy to prove. So essentially, that's a linear programming problem, is proving the nesting property. And once you have that, strong subadditivity is very easy. So assuming you can do that, then you get a proof of strong subadditivity that would be much simpler than Aaron Wall's proof. By the way, one thing I should mention is that if you do stick these all on one Cauchy slice, which you're free to do, then you get, and then you apply max flow min cut on that Cauchy slice, then you recover Wall's maximin version of HRT. So we actually have a whole bunch of different versions of covariant entanglement entropy. The fact that you can choose to spread them out in time, I think tells you, I mean, it's interesting because it basically, if you consider this causal diamond on the boundary, you know, these threads can move around not just in space as they can in the static case, which indicates this kind of correlations and entanglement within A, but also in time. Okay, so you can choose to locate the bits, the microstate bits of A at different points in time, as well as different points in space, which I think is kind of natural. You need energy conditions for this to work at all. Yeah, so that max flow min cut, the Lorentzian max flow min cut theorem, needs null energy condition. Well, our proof of it, maybe there's a weaker condition that would also be sufficient. So I shouldn't say it needs it, but our proof of it needs it. And certainly, if you throw out all energy conditions, it won't be true. And that's also true. I mean, maximin is only equivalent to HRT subject to null energy condition, and HRT only satisfies strong subadditivity subject to null energy condition. So without null energy condition, or possibly some weaker average version, I mean, that is not yet clear, all of this stuff is out the window anyway.